Okay, welcome to class, everybody. Welcome to everybody out there in the real world also. And this is our virtual worlds class day. I've been looking forward to this since the moment we started planning this class. I think it's going to be one of the highlights of our semester, not to get your hopes up too much before we begin. So just before we start, I want to tell you something a little bit about the activity that you guys are going to be doing outside of class this week. And this is the law students and the extension students together. And that is, in order to make what we do here today real for all of you in every audience for our class, we want you all to come into Second Life and experience the virtual world for yourselves. And so we've set it up for you to do that, for the law students to do that, in the most nicely cushioned possible way that we could imagine, which is that we've sent the Extension School students out last week to learn a little bit about the world. They've gone and visited shopping areas and bought some clothing and other objects. They visited some social areas and found some cool places to hang out. They visited some architecturally and environmentally interesting areas. And they've been thinking a lot about this and learning how to move around and all that stuff. This week, we're going to pair you guys up with Extension School students, you guys being the law students here, for them to take you on a tour around and answer some of your questions about virtual worlds and show you some of the cool places that they've seen. So in order for that to happen, you guys have to get avatars. And in order to make that as easy as possible for you, there are going to be two times when I'm going to be available to help you get an avatar. You can certainly do it on your own by just going to secondlife.com and downloading the software, watching the tutorial on our website that's already there and prepared for you. But if you want to get some help, tonight from 8 to 10 p.m., I'm going to be at the Harvard Extension School Computer Labs at 53 Church Street, and we've gotten special permission for you guys to come into those labs this evening in order to get set up with an avatar. And also on Thursday night, from 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock, I'm going to be available to help you do that as well. And then we want you to sign up for a time either Thursday at 8 o'clock or Thursday at 10 o'clock at night to actually go into Second Life. And if it's impossible for you to do those times, we also have a place on the sign-up sheet for you to write that, and then we'll try to organize some extension students to meet you at another time that you actually can meet and go into the virtual world. But if you can do Thursday night, please try to do Thursday night. It'll be most fun then. That's when the rest of the law students will be going in, and when we're hoping that most of you can arrange to do it. So I'm just going to pass around this sheet during class today, and you guys can sign up for a time that works for you. If you can't do Thursday night, please put your email address on the list also so that I know how to contact you to set up a time that will work for you. Okay, I'll start passing this around from in front. So the big question in front of us right now is, what are these virtual worlds? And let me just bring this microphone back so that we can get a good mic on the video for this video that we're going to watch, and then I'll start a little promo video of our own.
Single vacation you have ever taken.
I give up.
You? You're the same. No matter where you go, there you are. It's always the same old you.
Star Wars Galaxies, this isn't just a game. It's an online universe.
You can always log on. There's always something new there for you.
It's a persistent world.
Who hasn't wanted to visit Jabba's palace? And in there you can meet Jabba the Hutt,
Han Solo, the Emperor, Luke Skywalker.
I can actually talk to these people.
The world is a living, breathing, thriving place.
Today is the third anniversary of Second Life,
and the residents are not happy. Look at them. They've got their...
Substantive form of journalism being practiced in virtual America. Rob Corddry explains.
Like 80,000 other Americans, Peter Ludlow plays a game called The Sims Online.
Sims Online is a massively multiplayer online role-playing game.
It's a hot role-playing game that creates lives for those without them.
You create a character and then you can develop certain skills.
Yeah.
And the skills that you might develop include...
Okay, I'm listening.
Charisma, which you would develop by talking to a mirror or talking to a parrot.
You're losing me.
People make robots to maybe make pizza or make garden gnomes to sell to make money to buy tigers.
I had to find out what the hell he was talking about. So I took me to Alphaville, the largest city on planet Sim.
How do we steal a car and shoot some hookers? You can't. You could have a nice chat with somebody if you like.
Yeah.
And what if I want to shoot a hooker? I don't think that's allowed.
But in the midst of talking to mirrors and not killing hookers, Peter Ludlow discovered that the Sims Online community had a dark side.
There is a community dedicated to bondage, discipline, and sadomasochism. And there are plenty of cyber brothels.
And most disturbing of all, Granny Celesti.
The abusive granny, yeah. She is currently running a cyber brothel.
So Ludlow started an online newspaper, the Alphaville Herald, to blow the whistle on the thriving virtual flesh trade in The Sims. But it turns out the game's creator, Electronic Arts, didn't want its whistle blown.
Electronic Arts terminated my account.
I went down to Electronic Arts and confronted the game makers.
Peter Ludlow's just a journalist trying to do his job. Why does your corporation feel like they can muzzle him?
If Peter Ludlow's a journalist, then I'm a railroad tycoon whenever I play Monopoly. It's a fantasy.
Peter Ludlow exposed some very serious issues.
There is no sex.
There are cyber brothels.
Characters cannot have sex.
They're having rough granny sex?
Let me show you the passes for sex in The Sims Online.
So this is the sex that he blew the whistle on.
I'm not sure what he thinks he saw, but characters cannot have sex in The Sims Online. They can shake hands, they can dance, they can get in bed in their jams and not touch you.
Now we got a French maid using the toilet. That's pretty
obvious.
There may not be sex, but there is murder. Ludlow's character had a pet cheetah.
What about the cheetah?
They terminated my account, and for about a month he sat in his box with just his eyes looking up.
His evil corporation killed your cheetah.
The cheetah is no more, that's correct.
His cheetah just sat in its cage staring up. You deleted cheetah. You're a cheetah deleter.
He should have thought about that animal before he got himself terminated.
I needed to get to the bottom of this, so I jacked in and created a character that looked just like me. It's that bald. This world is a strange one. There were the garden gnomes, Ludlow mentioned. I spoke gibberish with a parrot. Danced in the monkey cage. Then I had a cup of coffee. With unexpected results. It was all very run-of-the-mill. Where was the sex? I went upstairs, and then I saw her. And the game's built for cleaning Johns. A little rougher than Ludlow had reported, but this was hot. At every turn was a new carnal pleasure. To a taboo even Ludlow knew nothing about. Tickle party. Oh god, make me giggle. Oh no. In the end, I couldn't save Peter Ludlow's paper, but I did learn something. I'd rather be shooting hookers.
Thank you.
Flip on the light again. All right, so introducing you to our two guests for today, Rodica Buzescu and Jean Koo. Rodica, it seems kind of silly. Well, you've been in this world, or you've been in virtual worlds for a long time. Tell us what's interesting about it. Tell us why it's not silly. Tell us why it's more than talking to parrots and looking in mirrors.
Well, I'm not sure about The Sims Online because I've never been in that world, but I've been in Second Life for about 2 years now, and the way I got interested in it was actually through my undergraduate concentration at Harvard, which was neurobiology. And when I was working on this Harvard Medical School course in neurobiology, one of the system administrator for the course had this idea of using Second Life to start a support community for people with Asperger's syndrome, which is a type of high-functioning autism. Usually people with Asperger's have trouble dealing with social situations, so they don't interpret social cues very well. So basically he started off a community in Second Life for these people to basically use it as a simulation to practice their social skills. So that's how I got involved in it, and I've been doing that for almost 2 years. And one of the members from that group, who also suffered from stroke, started her own community for stroke patients and stroke survivors to basically help each other get through and interact with their doctors, asking the right questions, that sort of thing, and also emotional support. So although most of these games and the images we've seen sort of portray virtual worlds as a play game and an environment for recreational purposes, something like Second Life can definitely be used for what they call serious purposes.
So how long have you been at it?
About 2 years now.
And how much of your life is invested in this? How much do you spend in the real world? How much do you spend in the virtual world?
That's a tough question. It depends. Before, I used to just spend 5 to 10 hours because I was going to school at the same time and working and stuff like that. But now that I'm graduated, I actually have a job where I bring real-life companies into Second Life and help them develop a presence there.
So you're spending a lot of time.
I'm spending a lot of time now, yes.
So we have Team Motumbo, consisting of Jordan, Art, Joel, Logan, Jessica, and Brianne. And I am hoping that I can ask Gene here a question and have him talk a bit, and then look to Jordan, Art, Joel, Logan, Jessica, and Brianne each to offer some question and kind of get us going. We've got a number of extremely interesting issues to explore here. Jean, what do you see in this as the issue of interest to you as a lawyer?
Can I ask a question of the audience, just briefly?
Go right ahead.
Very quickly, because I'm just curious, especially after watching this video, or actually willing to admit to this, but how many of you have actually played any of these kinds of online games? Okay, so it's actually quite a lot.
That was maybe a third for the record.
That's quite a lot.
Right, so to kind of go back to the previous question about, is this just a silly thing to be doing, it probably is about as silly as bowling, which is, it's something that you might do for recreation, but there's, Putnam and a lot of people have been studying, these are important elements of civic society. This is a way for people to have fun together, but also create social bonds, as a lot of you who play these games know. Sometimes it's just an excuse to meet other people, and the game itself, whether you're shooting robots or killing dragons, is kind of the way you look at this world. But what you're actually doing, for the most part, and what makes it so attractive, and probably a lot of you can speak to this, is being able to be there with other people, as opposed to just playing a game where it's you versus the computer. I mean, what's what seems to be really interesting about these worlds as you actually bring people together is are the same things that happen whenever you bring people together, which is that it all these same phenomena keep reemerging whenever you have groups of people. You have economies, you have societies, and you have law and governance. And all three of these play out in very interesting ways in these worlds. And you know, we could talk about any of those. You know, from an economic point of view, if this week's reading was talking about calculating the GDP of one of these online worlds, and this is from about 5 years ago at this point, and coming out with something like 135 million. You know, basically larger at the time than China and India, not China or India, somewhere between Russia and Bulgaria. Well, Bulgaria just entered the EU today, so you can, you know, it's kind of like imagining that you could take one of these online worlds and have them join the EU. You know, so from an economic point of view, there's actually real money transpiring going through here.
So you're saying that there's one of these worlds or all of the worlds together?
That was just one of these worlds, and that was back in 2001. And if unfortunately, I don't have any charts on me, but you know, these worlds have now expanded dramatically since 2001. Right now, for example, there are about, according to the last numbers that I have, which are from July, there are about 12.5 million people subscribing to one of these worlds right now, which is an order of magnitude larger than it was in 2001. So you can just multiply the GDP by that amount and just imagine that that's the kind of money going through there. But so, you know, I think what seems to attract the mainstream media is whenever you start talking about money, they're like, oh, well, there's something real there, and you start taking it seriously. But I think that, you know, from the point of view of this class, what's probably most interesting about these spaces is the way in which they do form societies and organizations of people, and how that lends itself to the potential for people coming together, governing, and what that means in terms of these spaces. I can keep going, or you can keep asking questions. One of the most interesting questions if you basically start looking at it, these are actually real worlds that people are starting to inhabit, and we can talk about that, and we can talk about to what extent are these real spaces that people are actually in. Some of the really interesting questions that come up are the same that that Lessig has brought up in terms of the internet. The rules of these worlds basically become the laws of these worlds, and much more profoundly than when you think about it in terms of for example, the internet, because you know, in the world that we inhabit right now, there's gravity, and you know, there's nobody to petition to say let's change the laws of gravity. But in these virtual worlds, all of these rules are actually up for grabs, and so there's a lot of potential there to shape how everything works.
So let's get concrete about that.
Absolutely.
For a minute. We saw at the end of this promo video that we were watching that at the third anniversary of Second Life, the residents were unhappy. They were holding up signs. What was happening? Yep. What were they unhappy about?
Well, LinaLab actually had, LinaLab, the creator of Second Life, had actually just released and made Second Life completely open access. So you didn't have to have a credit card, which is what you had in the past, or you can just sign up basically by giving them absolutely no information. And the way they further ensured some sort of identity and some sort of trust level is they would put in your profile that you have a payment on file, which meant that they have some sort of credit card related to your account or not. So there were a lot of sort of uncertified people entering Second Life. In a sense, it was good because most of the European countries and the European citizens could now join without having to go through the hoops of having a credit card. But on the other hand, there were questions of, you know, teenagers were no longer being, you could no longer assess a person's identity and age and anything like that. So a lot of people are unhappy about it, and that's what they were protesting there.
So give me an example. I mean, supposing right now I'm, I guess, one of these uncertified users, so Maybe I have no
position.
No, you're not,
because your account was bought through the Berkman Center.
Oh, I see. Okay. So supposing I were, actually, I do have one of these uncertified accounts under another name, which I'm not going to tell any of you. It's hard for me to imagine what it is that I would be doing, aside from being a teenager, that would be so upsetting to people. What would be the grievance against me from the point of view of somebody who's been there for a while?
Well, there are mature regions in Second Life as well as sort of PG. So there are things that you probably don't want, if you're a parent, you probably don't want your kid having access to.
So I, as a parent in the real world, would have a problem with this change. But is it that who, the people who are in there who are picketing, are those parents of people, of children who are going to get these uncertified
They might
accounts?
Be parents, or they might just be people who don't want to deal with teenagers coming in and acting like teenagers on their turf of land.
It's a little bit like the debate over immigration in many ways, and it you know, if you in I don't know if this was the if Casanova had made the same points in the readings that for this week as he did in his full book, but if you start imagining that these are actually virtual worlds with their own GDPs and their own spaces, then what he describes there is that basically people are starting to, in a sense, immigrate from the real world into the virtual world, that, you know, by essentially deciding I'm going to spend 20 hours of my life every week playing this game or being in this world, that's essentially moving your labor and your time and your recreation and all of that over into another place. And so you're invested in that place, and as such, you suddenly care about who's there and who's not there in the same way as we care as Americans who's in this country and who's not in this country.
So I'm going to have to paraphrase for the video the questions coming from the audience, so just I don't think your question is clear when you ask it.
Okay. So, I mean, I guess, I don't know, the comment about it's the same as the immigration debate struck me a little bit. Because on the one hand, I guess I can see the parallels there. On the other hand, I feel like the motivations behind immigration from one country to this country, for example, might be very different than the motivations that might lead one to quote unquote immigrate from, you know, Harvard to Harvard, in air quotes. So I can see how that might sort of make the parallel a little more complicated. I mean, I think a lot of people when they immigrate here, they're looking for economic opportunity at the most basic level that is already sort of exist. I mean, I don't know, if you got a computer, you know, and the ability to go into Second Life, you're already a step ahead of, say, you know, my grandparents when they came here after World War II or something like that, or a lot of other immigrants who are sort of at the locus of this battle today.
So the question is, how far does this immigration parallel really go? That real life immigration involves people with real physical needs that cause them to make the decision to immigrate, whereas all of us who immigrate into Second Life using air quotes, as Art puts it, are people who are already privileged enough to have a computer that can run this high-powered program.
I think that we should take the microphone and pass it around, because I see people wanting to get in, like, here.
Well, I guess even though I had the privilege of having a computer in middle school, for me, immigration was to virtual worlds was kind of like a necessity, because I lived in the boondocks, and I was like an hour away from all of my friends. So there was really no possible way for me to conveniently hang out with them after school. So what became necessary was, you know, a virtual meeting place for friends that I had in high school and middle school, as well as friends from all, like, the internet. And so I feel like a lot of people do immigrate into virtual worlds out of necessity. You know, there are people I know at Harvard who have actually paid for a significant amount of their tuition by selling stuff on EverQuest. And, like, you know, so people are making money and people are making friends, which are two things that I think are pretty essential to a lot of humans. So I think they're just as important as the economy, you know.
If I could quickly respond as well, I think on two levels. One is to follow up on that point. There's another great, that little segment in the beginning was kind of different snippets of virtual world created videos that are on YouTube. There's like thousands of them. And there's a preview on YouTube that you can search for of a documentary that's coming out about Chinese gold farmers, who are basically people in China who are working as jobs to
basically you know, play the game and sell the game artifacts like swords or whatever to mostly Americans, but you know, people with money, and they can actually make a living. And that's a very real example of how you can export labor. And it essentially, you're not immigrating in terms of leaving the country, but you are, in fact, basically exporting your labor in that method. And then the second, I think, in terms of what you're saying, is that it's true that probably a lot of people immigrating to the United States or other countries are doing for economic purposes. But I think one of the themes of this class is looking at, you know, non-market motivations as well. And it is very interesting to look at, beyond simply fulfilling your economic needs, what are the other needs that we as humans have, and to what extent does a world like this meet those needs or not meet those needs?
And it does also seem that we could look at the immigration question both from the point of view of the immigrant and the point of view of people who are established in the world, whose world they see being disrupted by immigrants. And that has many of the same kind of tensions that you find in the real world. Tell us who you are as we start.
Aaron Sokoloff, for the record. Again, I'm still having some trouble with the immigration comparison, because I don't see how this is different from any number of other, like, high-commitment recreational activities. Like, if I join a sports league, for example, I might be between practicing games, playing in it, you know, 5 to 10 hours a week. I might put a lot of money into it in terms of equipment. And there's also, you know, a kind of possessiveness. Like, if you're in a basketball league that you have to try out to get into, and then they decide to go to completely open membership, a lot of people are not going to be happy, because that would probably decrease the intensity and the quality of play and whatever. And, you know, people join it for non-market reasons, for fun, for social support, et cetera, et cetera. But we wouldn't think to say that someone's immigrating into a recreational basketball league. I mean, isn't that just, I mean, to me that seems kind of not that different, and the immigration thing is kind of just a reflection of how the game looks.
Aaron, pass it right back. Let's just keep going.
Thanks. Jonathan Kropp. And on that note, I think, like, the difference may be that while we invest some part of ourselves in all our activities to some extent, there's a certain type of investment that we put in what we feel is our life. And I think the difference is that for certain people, they think of this at least as one of their lives. It's a life to them. It goes beyond an activity. And so to that extent, I think it's a completely different order of magnitude in terms of the possessiveness they feel and the investment that they feel in it. And I think that changes the way they react to situations like this.
I just wanted to see, this is a little bit personal, I guess, but Rodica, would you say that applies to you, or your name I didn't get, but would you say that applies to you, that it really feels like it goes beyond an activity for you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I make friends there, people that I consider close.
You might make friends, I mean, not that you necessarily play basketball, but you could make friends in a basketball league as well.
Yeah, I mean, the connections are deeper, right? You get to be around throughout a whole bunch of things, you get to organize a community, so it really experience them.
So then maybe the analogy that's a little easier, at least for me to understand, is somewhere in between Aaron's basketball league and an immigration, but something like a church or a synagogue or something like that, where you have this community that's not a market-based community that is, or not exclusively a market-based community. You could, you know, make money through a bingo at a church or whatever, or Jerry Falwell. What, I mean, you know, you could also, but you have sort of people with, you know, similar interests organizing for a variety of different things, right? Churches run basketball leagues and soup kitchens and all of these other things. But I guess immigration to me implies something completely wholesale. It implies that you are uprooting everything about yourself in one place and moving everything about yourself into another place. And I still don't see that happening, right? Because you are here right now. You know, you can't immigrate from China or Poland or Mexico and then be in Boston, but also be in China or Poland and Mexico at the same time. You see what I, does that make sense? Is that sort of a, I guess that's how I see it working.
I don't think this is healthy, by the way, just for the record. But I mean, there are people who do that and who feel that Second Life is a better world than what we have in the first one.
But Rodica, why do you resist art? I mean, it seems like he's making a good point. It's like a form of dual citizenship. It's like, yes, we exist in the real world, we exist in the virtual world. We haven't entirely left one to go to the other. There are these. Uh-huh. KB.
Yes, I am Quan Bull, and I have another analogy that I think is a bit more apt. I take drugs, and to me, magic mushrooms are my favorite. And this is a hallucination, is what it is. I mean, you're looking. It's just, for God's sake, it's just a computer screen. I mean, you don't make friends. The screen, it types these little words to you, and you believe it. It's like, I mean, Second Life. It's more like an acid trip than anything else. You're not going anywhere. You're not doing anything. I mean, you're getting your jollies by staring at a screen. You're hallucinating. That's all it is.
Well, I've never taken drugs, so I don't know anything about this. For the record, exactly. But now, the points that you're making, it seems to me, can be made in a way about almost anything, and yet there's a residue left that you can't get away from. Like when we first started thinking about doing this class with a virtual life component, the question comes up, what does it mean to meet in Second Life? Well, you're right, KB, in one sense, that in a sense a class meeting in Second Life is a person sitting in front of a computer, looking at a screen, typing on a keypad. So it could be an email exchange, it could be just any web environment. And yet the feeling of having a representational reality in which you move in ways that make analogy to ways you move in the real world, and that allows you to use language that you use in the real world, somehow fills in a kind of rhetorical space that you live in a way that's genuinely richer than just a discussion board or just postcards going back and forth. In one sense, abstracted to the rhetorical world, everything is a virtual exchange. Everything is a signal you send out, you poke a key, and something that comes back. You see something happen on a screen. So the fact that what you say is true doesn't seem to me to undercut at all the reality of the space. I mean, turn around the other way. What is real about this space? What is real about this space? Pass it back to Art.
Bogart's probably an appropriate term right now. I haven't taken drugs, so I've never hallucinated, so I don't know if I can speak to the experience. I mean, it sounds like there are very real connections that get made between people. The community that you described for the stroke victims sounds like a remarkable, remarkable thing. And I can see how having sort of the ability to create a virtual persona could alleviate many of the obstacles that people in that situation might face. So it doesn't seem like, from what I understand about hallucinations happen, don't they happen mostly in your head? There's no sort of other interaction that's taking place, but in Second Life there is something very real happening, right? It's just, you know, I chafed at the immigration thing, but I don't think that necessarily means it's all the way on the other side of something that happens entirely in your head and then disappears as soon as the drugs wear off. Clearly, there's more than just residue. There's economies, there's connections, there's, you know, deep internal changes that people go through because they're more confident or something like that. So I think, I don't know, to call it a hallucination, maybe I misunderstand what you mean by hallucination, but it sounds like it diminishes a lot of this stuff to me.
That was all vegan and made with a lot of people about, which I think gets to the question, and I don't think it's the essential question of this class, but it is an interesting question about what is real and what isn't real, which is that in World of Warcraft, which at this point is the biggest of these games, it's about half of the market, 6.5 million people are playing World of Warcraft right now. There was a woman who played this game who in real life died, and some of you may have heard of this. She died, and her clan, which is how people organize themselves, and that's actually another interesting topic, decided to have a funeral for her, and in world, because they're all over the world, they can't actually go to the funeral physically. So they decide to have a funeral for this woman, who again, she died in real life. And they decide to host it in a place which allows player killing. There's parts of the world where you know players can kill other players, there's parts of the world where you can't. Just so that you can not always be constantly under assault by everybody else there. And what happened is their rival clan got wind of this and showed up at the funeral and just basically slaughtered everyone there in world. Now, basically you can imagine the reaction. When we were having a funeral, you came and you killed everyone. Well, the response from the other clan was, hey, this is just a game. Who cares? If the game, the rules of the game are, you know,
kill people. Why are you getting so upset? I mean, this was a brilliant strategic move. You guys had you let your pants down, and we killed you. You know, I would just ask what your reaction is to that. I mean, if this is a real thing, then that's a horrible act. You've just disrupted you've just disrupted someone's funeral. On the other hand, if it's not real, this is just a game. Then the people who disrupted that funeral were actually just playing the game, which is they were scoring points through, you know, smart strategic moves and slaughtering the other side. So, you know, I think that it depends on your response to that situation. Kind of tells you something about how you feel about how real these spaces are. And I was actually very surprised when I went to they actually filmed this. It's on YouTube. You can go look at it. They filmed the slaughter of the other side. They actually made it very dramatic. And there's a whole huge thread of discussion related to this. I was actually surprised by how many people who play these games, who quote-unquote live their lives in these worlds, were like, hey, it's a game. And what percentage of the posts actually made that point of view. I've been asking a lot of people about what their first response might be to that. So that's you know, I would just ask you to think about that, and does that tell you something about real or not real, I guess, in this situation?
So you'll have to excuse me. I'm going to get philosophical for just a minute.
Tell us who you are.
My name is Steve Schultz. From the phenomenological perspective, that is specifically the Heideggerian thread of this particular philosophy, which says we are all beings in the world that are being precisely because we relate to and are situated to the others that we encounter. It seems like a virtual world, to the extent that it affords us the ability to be situated and be interrelated with other people, is no less real than me sitting here talking to you right now. I have various ways of being in this world, appearing to you visually, speaking to you, etc. And Second Life affords me a few different ways of doing that as well. I think what initially made me think of this was the comments about hallucinations, because from the phenomenological perspective, everything is just a phenomenon that's appearing to me, and I choose how I interpret and interact with it. So from that perspective, the fact that it's a computer screen or a digital world that's not physically that's not physically represented doesn't matter to me. But I'm curious if you guys buy that argument.
Yeah, tell us who you are.
My name is Richard Heppner. I want to sort of piggyback on that a little bit and just say that there are probably other ways of sort of looking at the world that would say this is a, you know, a highly mediated way of interacting with somebody. You're looking at a computer screen where you're controlling a character that's talking or typing to some other character that somebody else is looking at on their computer screen that they're controlling. And that might be a sort of heightened amount or level of mediation for human interaction and community building and stuff. But I think probably not, it's not a question of, in this case, you're interacting only with the computer and otherwise you're really interacting with people, because these things are always mediated. I mean, we don't say, oh, you can't talk to your friends on the telephone. From a linguistic point of view, we all communicate through, you know, a machinery of language and stuff. So there's always a mediation in human interaction, and I think this, you know, allows for a lot of weird variety in it and also obviously limits it a lot. You can only do it on your computer, but, you know, you can be a frog while you're doing it. So I would say that this probably fits in well with the phenomenological idea that it's, you know, it is human interaction. It is sort of real in that sense, just as real as any other kind of interaction, just, you know, mediated differently.
All right, I kind of, oh, my name is Allison Healy, and I kind of have a question for you then, because it seems like originally the virtual worlds and like Second Life were meant to be open and for everyone to join, but now there seems to be a dichotomy between people who invest their feelings and realness with it and people who are just playing a game. So I'm kind of wondering if you envision a split, or, you know, like maybe it becoming more closed in little groups because people want to retain the stroke survivor groups, for example, and not have to worry about somebody playing a game and like interrupting it.
Well, I think the reason why the stroke support group is sort of successful in what they're doing is because it's an open community. It relies on people participating in the activities that they organize. It relies on people entering their space. Obviously, you need to, you know, not shoot bombs when you're there, but that's the rule of the place. And there are posters for that, and you get kicked out if you do that. But there are also regions in Second Life that are devoted specifically to playing games and shooting each other if you want to go do that. So there's, you know, there's a place for everyone if you want to look at it that way.
It's a little, I mean, it's basically no different than the rest of life, and certainly no different than the web. You know, you get all the spam. That's not what you want, right? So there's always people who want to do things that are a little bit different. And any social group, and I think this hopefully relates to the subject of the overall class, is defined both by who's in the group and who's outside of the group. I've been teaching classes in another similar platform called there.com. And last week we had our first bout with what are known as griefers, or people who just basically go around trying to disrupt things for the heck of disrupting things. So it would be like the equivalent of somebody actually literally coming to this class and streaking through here and then running back out again. That happens a bit in these worlds, and you know, maybe more often in these worlds than you would like to have it happen in real life, because maybe it's harder to catch them. But certainly there are people there with different purposes, and part of the question, and I think, you know, to bring this back to law, and maybe the original reason why I brought up the immigration thing wasn't actually to make a direct analogy between the two, but just to talk about how we set the rules for the society we live in, however you might define society, whether it's your small group of friends and who's your friend and who's not your friend versus a nation and who's in a nation and who's not in a nation. The game itself, or the simulation, whatever you might want to call it itself, gives you some tools to do that. But often, it's you as people who are coming together as in relationships who come up with the real rules. So, for example, in there.com, we can say, look, we can actually invoke a meeting and say, this is a meeting. And, you know, that gives you then the power to eject people. So as soon as they start shooting paintballs at you, they're out. So that's something that the technology gives you the ability to do, just like in, you know, we could call the police and have somebody remove them in real space. So those are some of the technologies that enable you to do that. But then beyond that, you want to think about, well, what are the social norms that then define who's in the group and who's outside of the group, and how might you enforce those? And to what extent does the technology enhance your ability to do that? And to what extent does the technology disable you from kicking people out of your group or spamming you or whatever the behavior is that they're engaging in?
Okay, so I think that this is a perfect point to just take a tiny break to switch the videotape. And then I want to pick up on exactly what Allison and Jean are getting into right now and talk a little bit more about the actual laws of these worlds. So let's take the tape change right now. So to pick up on where we left off, we just said that in their.com, they can have a meeting. And if they have a meeting, they can kick people out. And somehow a technological ability that's granted to them to have this meeting. So who gives you this ability? Who decided that you can have a meeting?
Right, so I think this goes to last week's topic of code is law, where the designers of the software came up with the idea that this is how it should work. And so they gave you the power to do that by basically, you know, in the code of the software itself saying, you know, you can create a group, and then, you know, as the person who created that group, you then have the power to kick people out of the group. And actually, Rodica is, you know, can maybe explain how in some ways she's more godlike in Second Life than that.
I think the ultimate god is sort of the Linden person who can basically go anywhere and you can teleport people to your location and things like that. But if
so, sorry, who are Linden people?
So the Linden Lab employees are, they have you know, Second Life avatars and their last name is Linden. Just like for you and I, and when we log in for this course, you know, I'm Ansible Berkman, you're Rebecca Berkman, you have a last name associated.
So just to make sure we have it straight for everybody, Linden Labs is the company that runs Second Life. This is a for-profit company that runs this whole world, and they have some characters that go around in the world and do things.
Right. So as part of that, you know, when you own a piece of land, like Bergman Island, for example, the person who owns it and the person who is managing the estate has certain powers associated with that land. So, for example, if people come and grief Berkman Island, I would send them a message saying that they shouldn't do that, and if they don't stop, then I can have the power to click a button and basically eject them out of the island.
So in their.com, when you have a meeting, you can do what you do because you own the land that you are on in their.com?
I think we're at least lessors, but yeah, close enough.
So it's sort of like owning. So somehow there's a difference between these two environments that we're talking about, and the differences are inherent in the ways that these companies set things up. So the companies have all these coders who build the software, but it's not exactly the way Gene says. It's not up to the person writing the code to decide what the laws are. The people who run this company, to a certain extent, dictate to the coders. So maybe this would be a good time to show the video about building in Second Life and talk a little bit about how these companies affect the way property operates and how that affects the economies in the worlds. So, Rodica, could you introduce this video a little bit as we watch it?
Sure. So what you're about to watch is, I think in August, as it says here, we had a live performance from Suzanne Vega in Second Life. So somebody made a guitar for her avatar that she would basically be wearing. This is the maker. So everything that you make in Second Life begins with a primitive shape, geometric shape, a cube, a sphere, which you can then position or reshape, cut, hollow, and then begin to, it's kind of like Legos, you know, you make a larger shape out of little tiny building blocks.
Can you tell us a little bit about this very skilled person who's building this guitar?
His name is Robbie Dingo in Second Life. He's a very, as you can see, very, very good at building. He's also an artist. He made this piece of movie that we're seeing right now.
And what would be his motivation for making the guitar or making even this movie of making the guitar?
He might just be a Suzanne Vega fan and wanted to be involved in her appearance in Second Life one way or another.
So who owns that property?
Well, the guitar.
the microphone.
Well, I can imagine that he owns it because he made it. But then he
yes, who owns that property?
So he owns the guitar because he made it. He also gave a copy to Suzanne's Vegas Avatar, so I guess he owns it also. And then Second Life, the creators of Second Life and Labs also maintain some sort of rights to basically show pictures or show that this guitar was made.
Obviously, since you can't exist outside of Second Life, it's sort of connected to the environment. So, Rebecca, I want to throw the question in your direction. You're asking about Second Life and their .com, and there are clearly differences between the two, but both of them are worlds that are owned by for-profit companies. And so the differences between the two are just simply different business models of a for-profit company realized as a virtual world. In a sense, there's a governance question that's right at the core. I mean, when you talk about governance in those personal, those virtual worlds, you are ultimately talking to a corporation. But somehow it seems that in this virtual world experience, the question of governance is implicit and wanting to break out of the corporate structure. And I was wondering what you have to offer on that.
All right, please jump in if I go on too long, because my dad knew this was my favorite idea about this. Just this morning, we received an email from an at-large participant in Norway. He and his wife have been watching the videos. Let me make a little aside about this right now, just while I remember it, which is that the democracy player that you guys have been using, one of our own law students discovered a fairly large bug in the democracy player when she was trying to use it, and we were able to report the bug, and it's been fixed as a result of our participation in that open software project, so open source software development project. So if you had trouble with it, please download it again and try again. Hopefully the bug is fixed, and thanks to us for having done that. But back to our friends in Norway who are watching this course at large. So this man, I think his name is Stian, although I don't know how to say it in Norwegian, is a proponent of open source software and loved everything we were doing in this course except the use of Second Life for exactly this reason, that this is a closed environment. The software is open source and it's run by a for-profit company. It's in a certain sense not in the model of the course that we're going for. And what this means is that they are essentially dictators in the space. Benevolent dictators, I would say. I mean, if you compare Second Life to some of the other worlds, Second Life has quite remarkably open laws. They give you the property rights to any property that you create. So this guitar belongs to the creator of the guitar. And not only that, they give you Creative Commons-like property rights over it in that you can set the different ways in which it can be shared. And this results in there being a huge amount of totally freely shareable really great stuff in Second Life that you can get without paying a single Linden dollar for it, and also things that you can buy that people really use to help make their livings. Contrast this with their.com, which has a different type of a model where you can't create your own things. In order to create something, you have to apply to the company to actually create the object that you want to create. And then once you've applied to them, they can either approve or deny it, and once it's created, you don't have any ownership of it. So then the thing becomes a sort of a public property. It's a more shared property system that they're working under. And it seems very likely that this difference between the two models has resulted in the huge popularity of Second Life, because people really are able to go in there and start their businesses and do what they want and have Linden Labs really operate in the background. Linden Labs is doing the sort of generative process that we've been discussing. They've given the residents the tools, and the residents have gone out there and built an amazing world filled with all kinds of interesting stuff, just for their own reasons, market reasons, non-market reasons, whatever else. But the stuff that's in there wasn't built by Linden Labs. But then, even so, at the core of it, we have this for-profit company that acts as a dictator in this world, that's telling us what the laws are going to be. So what I've become interested in, and what Stian alerted me to even more this morning was the open source alternatives to this that are developing. So for instance, there's a project called the Metaverse Project, which is just an open source virtual world software project. It consists of a server and a client that you can download and install, and it's still very much in the starting stages right now. But this poses an extremely interesting question from the governance point of view. If you have an open source version of the software, and the laws are really made by the code, what does that mean in terms of our ability to govern ourselves in these worlds? If we set up one of these, then we would be in the position of going about the democratic process of self-governance by figuring out our own rules for how we were going to edit this code and change the way the rules are shaped in the world. And it's not at all clear how that's going to develop at this point, but it would be an interesting project to try to draw enough people into one of these worlds and set up that kind of government independent of any company that's lording over it. So that's the issue as I see it. I don't know if you have a particular question you want to pose about it.
Well, I have an observation. When we started the Berkman Center, one of the first issues of interest was the internet governance issue. And ICANN formed, and questions of what the role of ICANN would be and how the internet would be governed were just on everybody's tongue. And the more people dealt with the question, the more unsatisfactory it seemed somehow, because the tools that people were talking about as the instruments of government appeared simply to be incapable of doing the job of governing in the space. And when you took the governance question to its extreme, you started to realize that we're so in the frame of thinking about governance issues as going to government to get a result, rather than this bottomly grounded base of pyramid form of interconnection that Rebecca is suggesting will have to be the form of governance in an open source virtual world environment. To me, it's a fascinating way to actually frame the internet governance question, asking whether it will be possible for an open source virtual world to develop a huge constituency and then resolve the problems of immigration or dual citizenship or kicking out of meetings or how it runs. I mean, when it becomes a matter of the people of the space deciding how the space is actually structured, then we really hit the base of that internet governance question, and I'm just fascinated to see how this open source project actually goes.
Back up, I'm a little fascinated by these same questions. And what's empirically, what's been going on in most of these online role-playing games is that it actually is a dictatorship, but it's a dictatorship a little bit more like, you know, Afghanistan. And the way that a lot of these worlds organize themselves is that you have the company and they are supremely powerful. They set every single rule you can imagine, but they're also for-profit companies, and so they can't abuse their customers, or else all the customers will leave. And the way that these companies basically operate right now in the game world, and that's different than Second Life or there, as we were just talking about, is that the game players themselves organize themselves into clans. It's no different than having a tribe. And then the clans are actually, in many ways, a source of power, and are the people who petition to the dictator in terms of, we want this or we don't want this. And so there was one of the big creators of these worlds named Raph Koster has, and he was most recently of Star Wars Galaxies, had come up with several, maybe even decades ago, a kind of bill of rights of people who play these games, of like all these things that people who play these games should have the right to. And no world, except for one very tiny one of like text-based worlds, has ever adopted this bill of rights. As it turns out, it's not just that the companies don't want this, but as far as he's been able to tell, as somebody who's run, you know, games with hundreds of thousands of people in them, the players themselves, the people who inhabit these worlds right now, would rather have, and in his words, would rather have a dictatorship than a democracy. They would rather make sure that the lights are on, somebody's taking out the garbage, all of those. I mean, you can basically look at some parts of the world and maybe understand that too. Like, you'd rather have, you know, all of these basic services being taken care of, then
you're there to have fun. Like, you don't want to spend 2 hours a day, you know, debating the latest bill. And in the legislature, you're there to kill orcs or whatever you're there to do. So it's understandable maybe in that realm of this particular, that particular subsegment of the virtual worlds, which right now is the vast majority of the virtual worlds, that is the desire of the people who inhabit these worlds is currently for this benevolent dictatorship system. Now, whether that would also be true of a more open space like Second Life, which is not intended to be a game per se, but rather just a platform for you to do whatever you want, and whether if Second Life, as Linden Labs itself tries to hold out Second Life, is basically the next version of the web. If the web was like one jump from like text to graphics and using your browser, then supposedly that something like Second Life would actually be the next evolution of the web, then you actually have to wonder, well, the web has standards that are, you know, a fought between open standards and, you know, Microsoft and other players who want them to be closed. I think that same battle is going to repeat itself if it turns out that these virtual worlds are actually going to be the next version of the web as we move down into the future.
So one thing that's worth noting to me about Second Life and in this regard is that it set up this benevolent dictatorship in such a way that it basically supports our regular old form of information economy, networked information economy that we've got here right now. It's got strong intellectual property rights and a market system. It doesn't exactly seem to go along with the open non-market idea that we're promoting in this class. How do you see that?
Can I might actually back up for a second because we had some questions during the interlude. About basically how does this economy work, and so that might not be clear to everybody about what actually is going on in these spaces. So there, all of these worlds have an internal economy where you have some form of money, whether it's gold pieces or credits or Linden dollars, and more or less you can exchange that virtual currency for cold hard cash. So you can sell it on eBay, or you can basically, and this is basically how Castronova then calculated the GDP of EverQuest, is that what people would do is they would spend hours acquiring the Sword of Armageddon or whatever, right? And then, because the Sword of Armageddon is like an almost unique thing, you can go on eBay and sell it to somebody else for, I don't know, hundreds or thousands of dollars even. What you're really actually selling in those cases is your labor in some sense, because it took you like 100 hours to get that sword. So you can go on eBay and sell it. Now, what does that actually mean in reality? It means that you then have to meet this person, at least in these games, I think it's different in Second Life. You meet this person in world, and the person hands you the sword. And of course, you know, it could be the case that the person never meets you and you just got ripped off, but that's no different than the rest of eBay. So, you know, so that's basically how you figure out how these economies work. Now, it turns out that Blizzard Entertainment, which created World of Warcraft, then tried to say, you know what, this is unfair, because what it does is it gives players with lots of money the ability to be super powered, you know, characters, and people without money are schlubs who go around having to do everything by hand. And, you know, these people can come in, spend $1,000 and suddenly have a super character and kill everybody else. That's not really fun. So they said, we're not going to allow that to happen. And so they worked with eBay to just basically get rid of all the auctions. And what happened is actually all those auctions then went off to another website altogether. So it turns out that it was actually kind of irrepressible in terms of that people want to sell these things, that they actually really want an economy to happen. And even if the companies try to stop it, it keeps going. So going back to the question of what is this economic structure, I don't know. You might be able to compare it to China. I mean, you've got yourself a political dictatorship in a sense, but the economy is open. So maybe it's more like that, and maybe at some point when people get screwed enough in terms of their economics, they might start demanding political governance too. It's the same question, like how we should we treat China. I think it's a very similar. I'm sure someone's going to destroy this analogy, but you know, I see some similarities there in terms of how that plays out.
So it sort of brings us back to the immigration question again, because what Rodica's working on right now, and what we have as the clearest example is American Apparel, is bringing these brick and mortar businesses or internet businesses into the virtual world right now, who are investing quite a lot of money into developing their presence basically banking on the Second Life system as something that's going to continue and investing in developing their intellectual property in this place at this point. And these are big actors with a lot of money. So if Second Life just decides to shut its doors or to change its system in some way, it would be interesting to know what the modes of protest are that would be available to these companies or individuals who would have their property revoked.
Yeah, any company that's interested in being hip relates to a basic factor in marketing, that if you want to be hip, the way to do it is to be in the hip place when people who want to be hip get there. And so Second Life looks like it's a focal point. To a lot of people are going to come, and when they get there, I want my brand there because that makes my brand hip. Yeah, almost.
I had sort of just had a question about that. Sort of, I'm sort of interested in the way that, real corporations are interested in interfacing with this. I'm wondering if it's, you hear a lot about how the video game industry, generally speaking, has become bigger than the motion picture industry. You know, whether or not that's true, I guess, is probably a debatable fact in terms of economics. But, people talking about product placement in games and ads and just sort of games generally, not necessarily online space. And I'm wondering, you use the word interact. And so I'm wondering, are corporations actually interested in finding ways to actually try and interact in a real way with people, or are we really just still talking about product placement? Like, I'm walking around Second Life and I see a Coca-Cola billboard, just like I'm walking around Cambridge and see a Coca-Cola billboard. And is that sort of a new method of marketing, or is that just, or is it just still product placement?
Address that. I think the connection to the games is very interesting too. I mean, I actually got involved in this class through a conference called Games for Change conference, which looked at how do you use video games to shape learning, and I think and to shape social ideas. And to go back, I cited him before, Raf Koster, again, a person who's created a lot of games and has this whole theory of games, talks about how games are basically fun because you're learning. And in many ways, the best kind of marketing that's out there is also about learning. So there was an effort, and for whatever reason it kind of ended, but there was an effort by Wells Fargo to try to create a space in Second Life to teach people about fiscal management and fiscal responsibility. And it was supposed to be a game, and it was supposed to be fun, and it was also supposed to teach you about fiscal responsibility while also, of course, branding you with Wells Fargo. So that's an interesting example of how you can actually use this. It's not just about billboards and feeling and kind of getting the brand name out there, but also giving people an interactive experience. And that's what's different about, I think, a game or a virtual environment. MTV just launched their own virtual world to try to get their own branding out there to get people to play in their own world. So it's a different approach to marketing and getting things out there. And I think it's something worth thinking about for, again, in the theme of this class, in what ways can that be used for other purposes other than branding? Can you use it to promote a cause? Can you use it to get people to think about different issues? There have been efforts in Second Life and outside of Second Life to raise the issue of Darfur and lots of other concerns. So, you know, those are all worth thinking about if you are looking for projects as a medium, as well as a kind of a population. These virtual worlds are very promising in that respect.
Say, you mentioned Darfur, and I feel obliged to bring to your attention, if I haven't, I want to put it up on the wiki, a critique of Second Life by Ethan Zuckerman, who is one of the Berkman Fellows who's in some ways most tuned into the future of the folks that I know. And he really objects to Second Life dealing with Darfur because he thinks it's virtual. And if you're going to deal with Darfur, you somehow should engage it in a much more real way. He's actually worried about distraction and somehow feeling that if you want authentically to engage the third world, you should do it authentically. It's just a thought. And I will put that critique, which Rebecca McKinnon sent to me with some of her incisive comments as well, up on our wiki page for the week.
Thanks. I just wanted to make, my name is Dan Roy. I just wanted to make two small corrections to the class discussion. The first is about whether or not video games are larger than the film industry. That is not true. Video games, broadly defined, are larger than domestic box office receipts. It's not the same as the film industry. The other correction I wanted to make is about Ralph Koster and his book, Theory of Fun, which is proposing, among other things, that, as you said, games are enjoyable because they're learning, but it's not learning, again, broadly defined. It's pattern recognition, so it's not the same as memorization.
So coming back to the question of protest and that type of thing in Second Life, I just wanted to, and this, of course, is not specific to Second Life. It's for virtual worlds of any sort, and the question of what kind of, how an online protest could be effective. I just want to bring up the suggestion that we're in the very nascent stages of this right now. So it's possible that Camp Darfur in Second Life is not an effective protest. In fact, I've been there and checked it out, and it just didn't seem to me like there was much happening that was going to make any difference that was there. But this, on its own, is not a good argument to say that virtual worlds are not a space where good protest can be organized. There's a question for us and for everybody who's residents of these worlds of whether it's something that we can use to improve the kind of protests that we're already making in the real world and add to them in some way. So there has been successful fundraising for philanthropic causes in virtual worlds at this point, and I think there's probably potential for stuff that we haven't imagined yet. And I'd just like to use that to segue just to finish up to the question of education in virtual worlds, which is what we're ourselves trying to do using Second Life this semester. And it's also a very, very new proposition for classes to be happening in these worlds. There's been a lot of teaching in Second Life, mainly teaching of Second Life residents how to do different things in Second Life. But we're arguably one of the most high-profile examples of taking virtual worlds to accredited universities and really trying to hold classes in these spaces. And it's very interesting to get in there and try to do it and say, oh, what is different about this? And I feel like we're having quite a success doing this at this point. The three of us have been in there, the four of us have been in there leading class discussions of all different sorts, but it's experimental. We're certainly going to be making mistakes at this outset and discovering ways that these worlds could be improved in the ways that they're used for this purposes. So I just want to, for one second, direct your attention to William James, who's sitting in the back of the classroom, who's one of the extension students who's just visiting us today, and just ask for a second if he has any comments just on what the experience has been like from the extension student point of view in Second Life.
Well, hello. My name is William James, as you all know, and I am an extension student.
Are you in Second Life?
My name in Second Life is USA Brody. I'm also on the wiki page. Being an extension student in Second Life, gives me opportunity that I couldn't, I don't know, guess have any other way. I mean, here I am having the same experience that all of you are experiencing in many ways. And you're at one of the, arguably, the top law schools in the country. You're learning under a brilliant man and his daughter. And, you know, like you're, the only difference is really the type of coursework we're doing, you know. But we can experience that as well. And all it is a click away. I can just go over to the law school link and look through their syllabus or look through mine. I participate in a lot of things in Second Life. We have a Moodle entry, a Moodle journal entry that we do once a week, and we document stuff from the readings. We watch the same videos. I converse with people in Second Life, you know, just like you're doing now. We bring up questions. We have talks. We IM each other. We have profiles. I don't know, like on the wiki, we put up information that we want to be known about ourselves. You know, it's very much like being in a real classroom. I mean, there are some differences, of course, but I guess you could say I'm part of the acid trip. I'm part of your acid trip. I don't do any drugs, but I know, for the record, air quotes.
Well, thank you, William.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me today. It's a very high honor to be standing here, so thank you.
And just to sort of bring that back around to the beginning, on Thursday in Second Life, we had our class meeting, and one of the things that we discussed in our small group was the question of whether it was real or not. And being in Second Life gave us the opportunity to make points in a way that we couldn't necessarily make just when we were sitting here. So USA Brody actually made this point, and it really, he said, this isn't real. And I'll show you why. And he flew right up into the sky and then crashed right down to the ground and got up and he was fine. There you go. It's not real. It couldn't possibly be. And that, you know, whether or not it convinces you about whether it's real, it certainly demonstrates the type of thing that Steve was talking about earlier, that we're given different capacities for the way that we express ourselves in our reality here and in places like Second Life, and there are some things that are diminished. We can't use our voices and things like that, but many things, capacities that are increased, like our capacity to change form or to fly through the air or to fall into the ground and not be hurt. So
let me take it one step further off into outer space. If you imagine a future in which flat screen panels are ubiquitous and software improves and images that are generated virtually appear and act more and more real, so that it's actually in some sense conceivable that we are walking around a 3D world that is populated at least in part with virtual figures. There is a question that troubles me. It seems to me in some way it will be a challenge of the future to bring up our children of the future so that they truly maintain the ability to distinguish real from virtual. One of the things that we discover as we explore the subject is that those two concepts are not necessarily dyadic. There may be some flow between the two. And when you ask the question about, well, how do we train our children on issues of that which is real and that which is virtual, at least I find myself running into some very provocative questions. For example, as parents, do you expect to raise your children, your little ones, to believe in Santa Claus? How many would say, yes, my two-year-old, I'm gonna do the Santa Claus thing? Well, a significant number. But now let me just ask you a question about it. Why would you do that? Here you are, you're a parent. You are the authority for your child. Your child trusts you. And you raise your child in a fantasy where eventually they figure out that you've lied to them. It's like at some point you got to fess up and say, no, really, I was putting you on all these years. Now take that question and turn it around. Can you imagine a function for bringing up your children to believe in imaginary figures, to believe in them? Is it possible that much of our rhetorical world is now shaped by rhetorical strategies to present us with various versions of reality, which we have been increasingly trained just to accept? We've learned it from the time we were this age, to accept fantasy and not to be too upset when we find out it turns out not to be real. Is this training for adult life? Or in the future, will we want to be paying more attention to actually tuning our kids in right from the beginning to being sophisticated consumers of virtual reality and real reality? And is there a real premium in a world that is inhabited by virtual beings of staying real? Well, that's my question to end the class with, and I am looking for maybe a couple of comments, and then I want to let you out early because I know we kept you late yesterday, and it's the worst sin a teacher can possibly do.
USA Brody.
Yes. Hi, this is USA Brody and William James in Real Space. I guess I just want to address what you said earlier when you asked the question, what is real about this space? Well, it is a real medium, and there are real individuals with real psyches and real disorders and stuff, and I think you bring up very, very important questions when you ask, how are we supposed to raise our children? You know, how are we supposed to distinguish this? And maybe you could even relate that back in a limited manner to distinguishing from bits and matter, like you did in the last lecture. Those are my only comments on that. So.
Well, I think it relates back to what Steve was saying earlier, and what you were also saying before. The fact that what is real? I mean, why should they be taught to accept what's essentially an illusory dichotomy? I guess his point was that everything is essentially just sense perceptions that we receive and interpret. And so why should we assign a label of real or not real? I mean, I suppose we could assign a label of crude or sophisticated. Like, for instance, the reality we inhabit right now is much less crude than the reality of Second Life, which has all these constraints and the interface is much cruder. But besides the difference in sophistication, is there ultimately a difference? We're just interacting with our sensory perceptions, and conceivably there are other sentient perceivers in that realm. Conceivably there aren't. I mean, that's a question that none of us will ever answer. But so why should we teach them to differentiate between real and imaginary? What's the difference?
Well, that's really the question I wanted to... One more up here. Patrick, go quick. I can't go over with information. It's got to be really tight.
I think the idea that's important is kind of how many layers of illusion are there over your identity. So in this world, we're interacting kind of at the first stage of abstraction from our minds. Like, we have these tools that we're very accustomed to. And so in Second Life, we have a second layer of illusion that we have to go through another layer of tools to interact with. And I think that's maybe a principled way of differentiating between these realities, is how many layers do we have to go through from mind and information to affecting them.
Well, yeah, I come from Colombia, where we produce all these drugs that you don't take. And so for me, in a way, what happens in this Second Life, where people kill each other at their funerals and things like that, seem in a way more real than Harvard, and where everything is so nice and so beautiful. So I guess this sense of reality is so subjective in so many ways. So, well, that's just what I wanted to say.
So let me just conclude by thanking Rodica and Jean for coming in and leading in this, and thanking you, Rebecca, for likewise putting it together. Class dismissed.